Hello, and thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you're the generous sort, you can support the podcast through Patreon with either a recurring or a one-time donation. If that isn't your thing, you can also buy Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, and stickers on the Teespring store. My name is Anders Halverson, and I am going to be hosting the Fisheries Podcast from time to time going forward. And with me today is another new host, Zach Crum. Zach is a fisheries biologist, and we are going to use this episode of the show to get to know Zach. Welcome, Zach.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be on the show.
So let's start at the beginning. Zach, tell us where you're from and how you became interested in fisheries biology.
Yeah, sure. So I guess my background in fisheries kind of goes back to about age five. And I don't know why I remember that I was 5 years old, but I just do. I started fishing with my dad over on the Eastern Shore of Virginia. So he took me along on these trips, and it was just this huge ordeal. He would drive me over to the Eastern Shore, which is about an hour or so from my house. And we would take a 30-minute boat ride over to some of the barrier islands on the Eastern Shore. And we would dock the boat there and leave it, throw all of our gear in a beach cart, and trek about 2 to 3 miles down the beach to find a spot that looked, quote, fishy. Of course, I had no idea what that meant at the time, just looking at my dad staring at the ocean for a long time. And eventually we would find a spot. And I guess this is where the magic happened. I just remember him bringing in these giant red drum to the beach when I was a kid. And the fish were bigger than me. And it was just the coolest thing ever, watching him land these huge fish. And honestly, from there, I would say that I was hooked. So I guess from there, I sort of evolved in my fishing expeditions going forward through middle and high school. I got really involved in a local speckled trout fishery in the Elizabeth River of Virginia, which was a ton of fun. On the Elizabeth River, there was a coal-fired power plant that used the cool river water to cool its machinery that would then discharge that river water back into the river, and of course, greatly increasing the temperature of the water. So this made for just an incredible wintertime fishery there. And, you know, all the bait fish would sort of flock to the area, and then giant speckled trout followed. And that is what really got me into fishing. I mean, it was 15 minutes from the house, so we're going 2 to 3 times a week and really just fine-tuning my skills in fishing. So yeah, it was the combination of those two things that really kind of turned the light bulb on for me and just made me realize, you know, fisheries is what I want for the rest of my life in terms of a career. So,
wow, that's great. I'm jealous. I'm still trying to figure it out. So you graduated from Virginia Tech in 2019. Does that mean you went into college knowing that you wanted to be a fisheries biologist?
Yes, absolutely. I declared a major in fish conservation my first year, and there was absolutely no turning back. I mean, I just became more confident in my career path, I guess, as I went through school and got involved with clubs like AFS in the chapter there at Virginia Tech. And I guess that AFS chapter got me involved and allowed me to go to a bunch of different conferences, whether Southern Division or national or just local meetings. And I really got excited about the idea of research in fisheries. And I guess from there kind of decided or was able to figure out my interests.
Oh, that's great. So you sent me a CV that listed all of the different internships you had while you were in college. And I have to say, I'm incredibly jealous. Could you walk us through all of the different positions you've held and the different internships you've had so far?
Yeah, sure. So I guess when you look at it, it's probably like, you're probably thinking, what the heck? This guy has no idea where he wants to be or what he wants to do. But I was able to do three different internships in college, and they were all so vastly different from one another that I really got to kind of test the waters in terms of a lot of different things. So I'll start with where I got my start in, I guess, field work pertaining to fisheries, or actually hatchery work. So I started going to a local trout hatchery that was about 45 minutes from the Virginia Tech campus in Paint Bank, Virginia. One of my good friends and roommates actually got me going. He would always come back home and tell me about all these giant trout that he got to hold the day before and all this stuff. So I was like, man, I got to get in on this. So I started going with him up to this hatchery, and right away got kind of immersed in spawning brook brown and rainbow trout.
Okay, so hold on for just a second. So you weren't an intern yet. You just showed up at the hatchery and the people there were welcoming and you were able to volunteer and step right in.
Yeah, so the Virginia, I guess at the time it was called Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. Now it's Department of Wildlife Resources, but they have a program called the Complementary Workforce Program. So this basically, all it is essentially a background check, and sort of a clearance into this program that essentially they just cover your gas mileage. So they reimburse you for your gas costs, wherever you're going to volunteer with biologists. With the department. So I went through this whole process and got involved in the CWF, and that kind of allowed me to go there and volunteer.
Wow, that's neat. Okay.
So yeah, I guess right away that's summer, which I guess was in my, I want to say it was in my freshman or sophomore year, got involved with spawning brook brown and rainbow trout. So we had all three species there at the hatchery, and yeah, that was just the craziest thing ever for me. Just here we are, knocking these fish out, something I'd never seen before, and picking them up and stripping eggs into a bucket and combining milt in this process that's been going on for, I guess, several hundred years or more at this point. And I thought that was just amazing. And I guess at the hatchery as well, they had a pressure canner that was used for triploidy eggs to produce sterile offspring. So I got to get involved with this a little bit, which is kind of a novel process, at least for the area in Virginia. We were the only hatchery to be doing it. So that was a lot of fun, and was able to produce a ton of eggs that were hatched in our facility or shipped across the country. Particularly remember shipping milt across the country to Utah for the department there to use to create splake. I thought that
No
was
kidding.
so
Wow.
crazy. To me, it just blew my mind as being a freshman in this field. It just that I helped create splake in Utah, I thought was just really, really interesting. And of course, another huge part of that internship was going out and stocking fish into the local streams in Southwest Virginia. It was just a ton of fun. You're running buckets and nets of fish through the woods, and just this whole process where you're involved with the anglers and yeah, taking the hatchery truck up all these mountain roads. And I really, really enjoyed my time there. So I guess my second internship in college was during my spring semester of junior year. So this was spring of 2018. And the Virginia Tech Fisheries Program allows you to either choose a marine or freshwater concentration. So I, being so interested in those red drum as a kid, chose the marine fish concentration. So I did this internship. I applied that fall and got accepted into a research internship with the Cape Eleuthera Institute. So this is an institute that is on the in South Eleuthera, which is a small outer island in the Bahamas. And yeah, it was just sort of this leap of faith. I mean, I was told going in that I'd have no access to cell service and would have to be taken 30-minute, or I'm sorry, 30-second military showers, and I was going to be in just shared housing. So it wasn't, just vacationing or in a luxury hotel as you would think in the Bahamas. But I got down there and I was able to get involved on three different projects. The first of which was a bonefish reproduction project. So essentially what we did, or what the ongoing project was we captured bonefish using either seine nets or hook and line in some areas close to the institute there in South Eleuthera. And we then took those bonefish back to the lab and allowed them to acclimate to the laboratory conditions. And, there was this whole husbandry process of feeding and cleaning, which of course is the dirty work, but also very fun. And so the idea there was to see if we could get bonefish to spawn in captivity. So this was something that had never been done before. And what we were doing was injecting bonefish with several different trial reproductive hormones to encourage egg production. So then we'd inject them with these hormones, and then throughout the month, and particularly around the full moon in the winter, which is when they spawn, we were cannulating them to see if they were producing eggs. And basically, shortly before I arrived, the program there had the first successful spawn of bonefish in captivity. So very cool to be involved with this whole process. And it was sort of winding down as I was getting there, because I was going into the spring, which is not when they spawn. So I enjoyed my time on that project probably the most out of my time there. I just love bonefish, and I loved fishing for them.
Are you a good enough caster to hit the bonefish when the guide tells you where to lay it down?
I wouldn't say right away. It was definitely something I had to work on. And I tried spin fishing, which is kind of hard because you're making a ton of noise and spooking them. And then eventually, which led to me fly fishing, which was actually quite a bit more productive.
Nice. Okay, and you also did something with fish aggregation devices while you were down there. So do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, definitely. So that, I guess I should clarify, the credit that I got while I was down there was an undergraduate research credit. So I guess the only stipulation of getting this credit was that you produce a traditional scientific manuscript on sort of a new subject. And I chose the fish aggregation device work for this small manuscript that I had to write for credit. And that project, what we had going on was we deployed, I guess shortly before I arrived, we deployed a handful of anchored subsurface fish aggregation devices, or FADs, in the Exuma Sound in the Bahamas. So this is.
Okay, so just a minute before you go too much further, can you tell us what a fish aggregation device is and how it works?
Yeah, so a fish aggregation device is, simply put, it's just any structure floating in the open ocean, or really anywhere, I guess, in water that fish can congregate around or something they're attracted to. And I guess there's several different theories regarding why they're attracted to floating structures. And to cover the two that I think are probably the most supported are what's called the meeting point hypothesis. And that basically says that evolutionarily, these structures have served as a good place for members of the species to, in an open ocean environment, to come together and reproduce. So basically, it's just something that they could, an indicator, so to speak, of where they could find other members of the species. And I guess the other theory is more in terms of their feeding and productivity. And it's that as logs and other organic structure were washed out of rivers into the open ocean, that took with them plenty of nutrients on which small fish and invertebrates and all sorts of organisms could congregate, which of course then big fish followed, and it served as a good place for them to find food. So, yeah, that's a long explanation of, I guess, what fish aggregation devices are.
No, that was very helpful. Thank you.
But for the ones that we had deployed, they were a cluster of three big giant orange buoys that were tied together and anchored to the bottom of the ocean, which was several thousand feet deep. And they were set down anywhere between 15 to 30 feet deep. So what we did, the purpose of the project was to look at how they were colonized and utilized by different pelagic fish. So we set about testing or evaluating this by deploying video cameras and looking at the different fish and the abundance of fish on these video surveys, as well as conducting visual surveys. So this was done either on scuba or just on snorkeling and conducted a transect across the FAD and looked at how many fish were present, what species, and so forth.
So FADs are often used by commercial fishermen, is that correct?
They are, yeah. So in other parts of the world, they're used by commercial fishermen to target species like tuna, I think is probably the biggest example. And oftentimes they use drifting FADs. So they'll just set a large structure out to drift with a GPS coordinate on it and follow that GPS point and set their lines or whatever method they're using to catch fish. And it seems to be very productive.
And does that mean that it's also a problem?
I think some would argue that, yes, as humans develop different technology that allows us to target fish in ways that we never have before. Yeah, some would argue it's probably almost too productive because we get too good at what we're doing and how we're harvesting fish.
Yeah. Well, as much as I'd love to keep talking about that, I think we better keep moving on. So tell us more about the next great internship.
So yeah, immediately from the Bahamas, I took a plane back home, stopped by and said hey to the family. And I think about 3 days later, I was heading down to South Carolina to intern as a fisheries management intern with the South Carolina DNR. So I was based out of a town called Rock Hill, South Carolina. It's just a very small town, about 30 minutes outside of Charlotte, maybe 45. And the office had one biologist and one fisheries technician. So it was this very, very tight-knit community. And yeah, right away, I just got going with boat electrofishing surveys. And we did these on all of our nearby lakes and rivers throughout the state. And yeah, this was conducted sort of as an inventory of warm water fish species in an effort to provide management with data that they could use to make recommendations for how they manage each unique fishery.
Okay, so now you've hit Virginia, the Bahamas, South Carolina. What's next?
So from there, I guess I was going back to school to finish my
All
senior
right.
year at Virginia Tech. So I finished up there in with my degree in marine fish conservation there at Virginia Tech. And so I was on a plane 2 days later to Anchorage, Alaska, where I was going to be working as a biological science technician with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So after moving there, yeah, it's kind of another scenario where I kind of got thrown into it right away with field season beginning quickly. And I started working on a project that was evaluating juvenile salmon, Chinook and Coho salmon productivity in the Deschka River watershed. So I guess I should give maybe a little bit of background about the Deschka. So the Deschka River is in South Central Alaska, and it's a non-glacial system that is particularly vulnerable to high water temperatures and climate change associated factors, being that it's particularly tannic and slow moving in some of its lower reaches. So the Deschka has historically had one of the largest runs of king salmon in the state, but in recent years they've seen declines in escapement at the weir that Alaska Department of Fish and Game operates. So our project was aimed at assessing juvenile salmon productivity. So basically what we did was mapped out a bunch of different sites that we would like to sample in throughout the Deschka River watershed. And this was done on two of the headwater streams, which are Croteau and Moose Creek, and then all the way down almost to where the Deschka meets its confluence at the Susitna River. And basically what we did first was deployed a network of hobo temperature loggers. And then from there, we followed that up with sampling for juvenile salmon using baited minnow traps at each of the different reaches that we were monitoring temperatures in an effort to sort of correlate salmon productivity with water temperature.
So, were you able to draw any conclusions or develop any hypotheses about why escapement was diminishing and what was going on?
So I guess being that this was the first year of the project, it's hard to say with any real definitive to make any real definitive conclusions about some of the things that were going on. But I will say it was a very, very interesting and unique year to start this project. So we had temperatures on the Deschka River reach over 27 degrees Celsius while I was there. So I remember there were days in the town we were staying in, Trapper Creek, Alaska, where the temperature was over the mid 80s and into the 90s. And this to me was crazy. You know, I expected to get to Alaska and just be freezing every day, but that was definitely not the case. So this was huge because when water temperatures got to this level, we stopped seeing juveniles in the majority of our sites that weren't in some of the headwaters where temperatures were still below about 12 degrees Celsius.
So one possibility is that it's a function of temperature.
Yeah, certainly. I think it's as climate change impacts those northern latitudes at a faster rate, I think it's definitely one possibility. Another is that the Deshka also has what I would perceive as an increasing population of northern pike, which are invasive in the system. And that type of habitat there with just slower moving water, a lot of horsetail and vegetation up on the banks, really works well for northern pike. I think they can really capitalize on this. And I'm assuming that they prey on a lot of juvenile salmon.
How did the pike get in there?
You know, I'm not honestly sure. I'd probably have to look back at some of the literature and see if there's anything on that. They are native to Alaska, just areas that are to the southeast of there. So in the same year that I was there doing that work, there were reports of dead pink salmon on the lower Kuskokwim River, as well as dead chum salmon on the Yukon River. So it seemed that even in other systems that there were all these indicators that there's problems. I'm, of course, attributing to high water temperatures.
So potentially climate change, but who knows? It's a complicated world, right? So what are you doing now?
Yeah, so shortly after I left Alaska, of course, those are seasonal positions. So I worked that season there. And I want to say it was late September. I flew back to Virginia and got in my truck and drove across the country to California, Sacramento, California, where I'm working as a fisheries technician with the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission on the Central Valley Steelhead Monitoring Program. So this is kind of a big program, but I'm functioning as a technician on one aspect of it, on the main stem Sacramento River, where we have about 10 fike traps where we're sampling Central Valley Steelhead 11 months out of the year.
So tell us about the steelhead in the Sacramento. How are they doing?
So historically, the Central Valley had huge runs of steelhead and Chinook salmon, for that matter. And over the, over the last 150, 200 years, we've seen huge declines in this area. And before our project, there was no specific population monitoring plan for Central Valley steelhead, which are a threatened distinct population segment as listed by NOAA. So in this listing, that requires them to have some sort of population monitoring plan. So that's where we come in. So our project has several different components. And among those are an out-migrant trapping project on the upper Sacramento River. There's also some spawning ground surveys and escapement monitoring going on up there with weirs and sonar cameras. And there's also some hatchery and angler harvest sampling, as well as our fike trapping project. So our project was set up initially as a mark recapture project to try to get a population estimate of Central Valley steelhead.
So can you tell us a little bit more about what led to the decline of the Sacramento steelhead population?
Yeah, the Sacramento River has seen huge hydrological modification, multiple dams, as well as water diversion into Southern California, which is a huge, hugely complex issue here in California, is how we manage our water. And I think this is one of the biggest factors in Central Valley steelhead decline.
And this summer is going to be even more interesting, I suspect. You guys have been in a drought there for how long?
Yeah, so we've been in a drought as long as I've been in California. So over the last 2 years, we've had this drought ongoing here. And this year was, I believe it was worse than last year. Just no rain when we need it. And the river is extremely low, which not only does it hinder trapping, but it hinders fish's ability to get upstream and spawn.
And you have a lot of stakeholders besides the fisheries biologists and the fish. A lot of people interested in that water.
Absolutely. Yeah. Water here, I mean, it's going in a million different directions, it seems. It becomes more complicated by the year. There's tons of water going towards agriculture, and the agriculture being the biggest, but also water being shipped through the California Aqueduct down into Los Angeles for drinking water and all their uses down there. And it seems that when you pit the interests of humans and our society and agriculture and food production, it seems hard to imagine a scenario where the fish win.
Yeah, for sure. I imagine it's going to be a long, hot, probably volatile summer out there. but I guess we should move on. Tell us what you are going to be doing in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am finishing up my time here on this project over the course of the next month. It's going to be a very busy month as I prepare for the next step. So I'll be attending Salisbury University this fall to obtain my master's in applied biology. So I have a big move across the country coming up here at the end of July, where I'll be heading to Maryland.
And are you working with anybody there in particular?
Yeah, so I'll be advised by Dr. Noah Bressman. And it's kind of an interesting story in how I came to get into contact with Dr. Bressman. So initially, of course, I've been a big fan of the show now for about a year and a half. And I remember when I was working last summer and COVID had just hit. So we were all in individual vehicles and we had about a 30-minute drive between our trapping sites. And I was always driving in the work trucks and trying to find something to listen to. And oftentimes I would play the Fisheries Podcast. And I would just go through and listen to different episodes. And one day I happened across Noah's episode and I got through it. So for a little bit of background, Noah works with, in his past, he's worked with amphibious fish, walking catfish, and a little bit with snakehead. I'll let you tune into that episode to find out more. I don't want to spoil it. But I just finished that episode and I thought to myself, like, wow, this is just the most unique stuff that I've heard about maybe on the show, and it's just so different. And so I just went ahead and I followed him on social media, and you know, I started seeing the things that he would post, and it was all really cool stuff. So I was excited about that. And one day I saw that he had posted that he had accepted a professor position at Salisbury University, and that he encouraged graduate students to apply for his lab. And so I did. So I reached out to Noah earlier this year and had a conversation with him, and you know, we kind of hit it off, and yeah, one thing led to another and ended up being accepted into his lab there, and we'll be working with him starting this fall.
Oh, that sounds great. Good for you. And let's not forget, you're also going to be hosting the Fisheries Podcast.
Yeah, I'll be coming on as a co-host with everyone. From my understanding, we're bringing on several new co-hosts, so I'm really excited to get to know everyone on the show as well as everyone that I'm going to interview. I think it's going to be so exciting to get to talk to all sorts of different people and share the stories of people that absolutely love fish, like myself.
Nice. And looking even further into the future, where do you see yourself in 10 years?
I guess that's a tough question. In 10 years, well, I hope to be finished with my master's degree by then. but I guess, as far as a dream job, I think I would really like to work as a research fisheries biologist with either NOAA or maybe the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, working with game fish ecology and conservation, maybe on the East Coast or maybe some other part of the U.S. that I haven't gotten a chance to work yet.
Wow, I'm not sure there's too many places left that you haven't visited. Maybe the Rocky Mountains. Maybe you should come out here.
Yeah, I would love that.
Well, I have to say, Zach, that listening to you, I don't know why anybody would want to do anything else besides major in fisheries biology and be a fisheries biologist. The things you've done and the places you've been, they're just amazing. Okay, so now I'm going to finish off with what I think are the standard five questions on this podcast. So number one, Zach, what is your favorite fish?
So my favorite fish by far, no hesitation, is the red drum. All those memories as a child, yeah, fishing for them with my dad, and as well as family friends, it just kind of, yeah, it really instilled this love for them that, you know, in a lot of ways, I think they're kind of the perfect fish. I mean, they can tolerate almost fresh water as well as completely salt water, of course, and they can adjust their feeding strategy to many different things, particularly as they age and shift their prey from crustaceans to large fish to blue crabs and really anything else that you can think of in the Chesapeake Bay and sort of on the East Coast and the Gulf as well.
Wow. Okay. I'm convinced. So question number two, what is your favorite memory from your career in fisheries biology? And we know your favorite memory involves red drums, so we'll stipulate that it has to be something else.
So my favorite memory in my career so far, you know, there's a lot of them from the field, and all my jobs have been so field-based. I've really been privileged to get a lot of time outside, and that has led to a lot of different experiences with really cool fish, but also something that is maybe less talked about or less glamorous in the eyes of some people, but people. You know, I've worked with a lot of different people, and I really enjoyed making different connections and different friendships in this field. So my favorite memories go back to when I was in Alaska working with my crew of four people up there, and we were going on 5 to 7 day canoe trips in the backcountry up there, and I had never done anything like this before, so it was just all new experiences for me, backcountry camping and fishing in my spare time after work, of course. And yeah, I just remember nights up there. Well, I guess it never really got dark, but sitting by the fire and talking with these people and really just building friendships. And I think some of those smaller moments just really stick with me.
Nice. Like I say, you should be a recruiting officer for fisheries biology. Okay, next question. What is your dream job?
My dream job would have to be working with the federal government. So I really enjoyed my time with them, although it was limited. But I would love to work with NOAA or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a research biologist. I'd have to say my dream location for that would, I think it would probably be the East Coast of the United States, working with some of those saltwater game fish that I grew up fishing for. But I think that could change. You know, everything changes as time goes on. So I could definitely see myself trying something new, maybe.
Okay, we won't hold you to anything then. So if money was no object, what is one project you would like to work on?
Yeah, close to the same thing. It's hard to, in fisheries, it's hard to imagine a scenario where money is not an issue, as we're so oftentimes tied to funding and things like that. But I think my dream project would have to be working with game fish that are popular in particularly the Chesapeake Bay. I'll focus in on that. I would really love to just get a ton of maybe satellite and acoustic tags out into some of the large game fish that migrate into the Chesapeake Bay every year. A lot of the management and sort of our knowledge on large fish in this area is very limited in terms of funding. I mean, tags are super, super expensive. And if I had all the money in the world, I would just purchase a bunch of tags and come up with a project to get them out into a bunch of different species, whether it's striper or cobia, particularly Atlantic tarpon, which a lot of people don't even know migrate into the Chesapeake Bay. And I would love to partner with local anglers and guides to get some of this work done. And I really think that would promote sort of an understanding or maybe an appreciation from either side. So anglers working with scientists, I think, can really get a lot done.
That's a good answer. Okay, final question. If there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Yeah, so for this, I would say don't let small obstacles stand in your way of going somewhere new and doing something that you're completely unfamiliar with. I think I've had several points in my life where I've had these sort of leaps of faith, and at every occasion, they've worked out better than I could have even imagined. So this is something that I would encourage everyone to do, is just get out of their comfort zone and try something new.
Sounds like good advice for life in general. Okay, so Zach, if people want to contact you for any reason, what's the best way to get in touch?
So the best way to do that would be to send me an email at zachc9@vt.edu. That's ZACHC as in cat, 9 at VT as in Virginia Tech dot edu. You can find me on Instagram at zachcrum_. I don't have a whole lot on there, but you can see some of the highlights of my different fishing adventures and career so far.
Sounds good. I'm going to go check that out right after we hang up. Okay, and I suppose people can also get in touch with you through the Fisheries podcast as well, since you are going to be hosting here. And speaking of which, I will talk to you again soon. Thanks again for an enjoyable interview.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed it, and I can't wait for the roles to be reversed, and I'll be interviewing you here soon.
Sounds good. Okay, well, once again, my name is Anders Halverson, and I have been talking to Zach Crum. And if you would like to get in touch with either of us, you can find us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram at FisheriesPod, or via old-fashioned email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or buy some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, and stickers that are available on Teespring. Again, I'm Anders Halvorsen, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast.